Hello, everybody. Why on earth has he chosen to do this pretentious opening sequence on this particular episode of Doctor Who? I hear you all asking. That's because it's quite a pretentious episode of Doctor Who. But that is a contentious opinion which is countered in this episode. And one of three reasons why I've chosen to do this introduction is, one, so I could put a snatch of the music in it, because I think it's wonderful and everybody needs to hear it. Actually, four reasons. Two, I think the fact that you can have a contentious argument during a conversation about Doctor Who is a really healthy thing, as long as you still remember to love each other at the end. And this is what happens when me and Dylan Rees and Luke Malloy come together, two of the most wonderful people I've ever met through Doctor Who, from very different walks of life, and we've come together. We never agree on anything. We literally never have an opinion that marries all three of us, but we sort of get to come together, battle it out. It means that one of us is usually on the back foot, so the other two are doubling down on their opinion. And it's just so healthy. It's so healthy to have a safe space where you can talk about this stuff and, you know, disagree and still adore each other at the end, which I hope we all did at the end of this one. Somebody didn't like this episode and the other two did. And I think it makes for a more balanced and interesting conversation because of it. Another reason is I just wanted to say how much I adore Luke Malloy and Dylan Rees. Two of the finest gentlemen you'll find podcasting about Doctor Who. And I need no other reason to do this introduction but to say that to the pair of them. I know they're both cringing right now, but fuck you guys, all right? And the third reason I want to do this is because we've reached a milestone. This is the 700th episode of A Hamster with a Blunt Penknife to be recorded. Probably won't be the 700th to go out because I bring them out all out of order, but it is to be recorded. I numbered them as I go, and what a milestone, man. 700 episodes, that is talking a whole bunch of bullshit, isn't it? But so this is just a massive thank you to everybody that's ever pressed play and enjoyed this stuff, or not enjoyed this stuff, or shouted at their speakers, or used it as company, or just background noise to go to sleep to, or whatever you do with this podcast. Thank you very much for pressing play, and just a massive thank you to every contributor that's given up their time, because we're well into the, you know, over 100 contributors now, and you're all just wonderful. So yeah, 700 episodes. Sort of ranging from half an hour to 3 hours long. Man, oh man, that is a lot of runtime. Thank you for your opinions and thank you for pressing play. And I really hope you enjoy this episode. It's one of my favourites.
Welcome back to A Hamster with a Blunt Penknife, a Doctor Who commentary podcast. I'm here, I'm Dylan Rees, and sent directly from heaven, it's Luke Malloy joining us. Luke, how are you?
Hello, I'm excited. I'm very excited to be watching the best episode of Doctor Who of all time.
Right, exactly. Well, me too. And he's hell-bent. It's Joe Ford.
The best episode of Doctor Who of all time as voted by DWM readers.
Well, not
those people that want Doctor Who to be the most serious, tedious thing ever.
Well, it's not just the readers of DWM. This was well received by press, like across the board, not just genre press. The AV Club gave it an A. Haste Magazine gave it 10 out of 10. SFX Magazine, 5. TV Fanatic, 5. IndieWire, A+. IGN, 9.5. Pop Matters, 9 out of 10. New York Magazine, 5. Radio Times, 5. Rotten Tomatoes, got a score of 89%. So it's not just Doctor Who fans that love this. It is loved across the board.
I do know a few people that work for some of those publications, and they're all a load of cunts, you know. So who cares what those people think as well?
Well, do you care what I think?
I do.
Always, always.
Because I think this is the best angelic episode of Doctor Who. Especially of the modern series. Of the modern series, definitely.
Okay.
It's in my top five, but it's not my favourite.
I think objectively, And I know we got into this last time. But I think objectively, it's the best directed. It's the best written. It's one of the best looking Doctor Who episodes. And then on top of that, I've got a personal memory of loving it the first time it went out, which I get into, which always helps. And I think because I hadn't been enjoying Series 9, which I'm sure is a discussion we'll get onto, having this absolute diamond drop out of nowhere and surpass all expectations, again, just lifted it. This is just incredible for me. And I know you will say that this isn't one that you watch often, if at all. But I will put this on. Yeah, it's probably one of the only ones from Series 9 that I will put on. I'll put them both on as well, but that's getting into spoilers for the next episode.
This is one I revisit, one of the Doctor Who stories I revisit the most from the new series. It's only been...
Why?
Because it's a fantastic bit of Doctor Who and a fantastic bit of television. And I think there's a certain amount, as Luke said, of like reliving that first moment and that reaction you have to an episode and just being like, oh wow, this is new ground. This is Doctor Who doing something it hasn't done before. And showrunners often wheel that out as like, oh, we're doing something completely new. And it's like, oh, actually, it's just the robots of death, but with different robots or something. But this is, I cannot think of another Doctor Who episode like this. And the themes that it deals with, and the, like, it's a very layered story.
I really want to get into all of that because I think I'm a little bit lost with what some of this episode is saying and what some of the symbolism is. And I think that's part of the problem for me. I forgot to say, I watched this and I watched Hellbent, and we're recording both tonight. And I said to you both earlier, I've had a bit of a surprise with one of them in a very positive direction. And that was Hellbent, which I actually quite enjoyed far more than I ever have before.
I thought you would.
But my unpleasant surprise was I found this to be fucking tedious to watch through again. Really very dull, just a hell of a lot of man, but I felt like I was watching the entire season of Buffy series 6 condensed minutes.
Let's not get into spoilers for Buffy.
Oh, have you not watched that yet?
I'm still not sorry.
Okay, well, there's a lot of pain in Buffy series 6, I'll say that at least.
Okay,
does she punch through a wall for 45 billion years or whatever it is?
She punches. No, I can't say. Luke's right there. Look, I don't want to let him know. But I didn't want to just come on and do exactly what Luke did when we did Spyfall, which was just come on and shit all over it.
Whoa, with
no great argument to his name.
I think it's just not.
I just don't like her.
I think there's pretty good
like
arguments in that podcast. I spoke for a majority of the audience in that podcast.
What I did instead was I watched it this morning and I started live messaging my friend Nathan, who loves this to pieces, yeah? And about a third in, he said to me, you're literally finding reasons not to like this. And I said, no, I don't like this. That's the problem. And I'm trying to interrogate why I don't like this, because I can see this is a well-written piece of television. I can see this is an extremely well-directed piece of television, brilliantly scored, excellently acted. So why doesn't this resonate with me emotionally, intellectually, and on all those levels that I want it to? Because everybody else loves it. So why don't I love it? Why does this leave me completely empty watching it? And I came to some conclusions, but I'll sort of go into those.
Are these issues with you or the episode?
I think they're with me. I think I certainly feel like the way this episode deals with grief is pretty appalling. And you know, and speaking as somebody who's, I'm sure we've all dealt with grief in different ways. Well, we'll get into it. But I just wanted to say, yeah, I'm not here just to say, oh, I don't like it, because where's the fun in that when you two love it? But I'm going to offer an opposing viewpoint every now and again, but mostly give the stage to you guys because you love it.
Okay, great.
Yeah, I mean, if you ask me why I go back to it and watch it, it genuinely does set my pulse racing. Like, as I remember the first time I watched it, and as the sort of realization hits towards the last 15 minutes, and the music is astonishing in it, that just swims it by. I mean, Capaldi's magnificent in it. I just think it's a brilliant, brilliant watch. It never at all, I can struggle with slow or a sort of weirdly paced, or things where you have to be patient. And I'd say some people would argue you have got to be patient with Heaven Sent. I do not find that at all here. And there's sort of emotional beats that work. I mean, I think all the emotion works in this. And as I say, when I watched Series 9, I wasn't particularly fond of Clara. I wasn't particularly enjoying the show, but I still found myself coming out of this absolutely heart-pounding, astounding emotion, thinking that is one of the best things I've ever seen.
Yeah, me too. I, in that last 15 minutes, when it suddenly starts to click what's happening, I stood up and applauded at my television. the first time I saw it, I remember it. I was jumping up and down. I genuinely thought it was the best bit of Doctor Who I'd ever seen at the time.
My heart started pulsing as well. I'm like, is that old man finally going to get out of that castle and go and do something? Please.
No, when we get into it, I'll tell you my story of watching it.
I can't wait.
I was in tears with just absolute joy at the end of this episode.
Me too. I have a story to tell too, but I feel like we're going to have a lot of time to tell stories because, you know,
nothing just happens in it.
It is just someone dicking about in a castle, really.
I will say, though, Luke, I do need to talk about a Buffy episode in this because I really want to compare this to a Buffy episode and there is a spoiler in there. So you need to be warned for that.
Which series?
Okay. Series 5.
Have you seen Series 5 yet?
Yeah, I'm halfway through it, so I'm probably like an episode out. Is it the big one that everyone knows? Like,
yes.
Yeah. Okay.
Yes.
I don't know.
It's an episode that deals with grief a million times better than this does.
I've not seen the episode, so any plot details about that episode will be a spoiler, but I know what, like, the consequence of it.
Okay, good. Well, we should watch it, shouldn't we?
Yeah,
shall we?
Let's get it on.
I don't want to have seen it before.
No. I'm just going to prepare myself for the sheer level of brown I'm going to watch in this episode, because it is a very brown episode. Okay, well, someone count us in.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
It's so weird when you two are so reverent about something. You're so polite.
I mean, I remember in the build up to this, like the weeks before this, this was already being talked about as it's experimental. It's like it's going to be a really one off. And then when the advanced spoiler free reviews came out, they were like, you could just sense in the way they were written, it was like, no, this really is fucking good. This is something special. So I was so excited for
That's quite shocking to start off with, those bloody footprints on the path there.
We never get blood in Doctor Who. Is one
you don't in the new series, do you?
Not until he attaches two cables to his head in half an hour's time and his blood coming out on his head everywhere.
Oh, God, I thought Dylan was going to be frozen for 4.5 billion years there. Are you still with us?
I'm still with you. It's all gone terribly wrong already. It says my internet connection's unstable, much like Peter Capaldi and his grief.
What did you think about Clara's death then?
It was one of those where I think at the time I cheered, and now I sort of think like that was quite bad, and I didn't really get the character properly.
But
I also, like every other fan, knew that she had to be back because she was on the front cover of Doctor Who magazine.
She was in that diner, wasn't she?
Yeah. So
yeah. Also, they were never going to write her out in episode 11, were they? It's just not what you do.
Yeah.
Or episode 10 or whatever it is.
Weird thing about killing them off and bringing them back a little bit later, doesn't he?
It didn't have the impact, but the consequence of it has the impact, because this is the consequence of it.
I mean, I really liked Face the Raven, by the way. I thought it was a cracking episode. I did find the ending of course you did, if I liked it.
I'm ambivalent.
Nothing happens in it.
She gave about 3 speeches before that bird came after her. It's the slowest Raven on record.
Yeah, but the good one is Capaldi's speech where it's like, I'll go and get the Daleks and the Zygons and I'll bloody kill you, you bitch.
But that's what's weird. I felt something when he said all of that. And you know what? The second he was back with her in Hellbent, in that diner at the beginning of I felt something then. I just felt nothing watching this.
Really?
Wow.
We'll get into the Hellbent stuff.
I wonder if
that is like poetry on screen.
But I wonder if it's because a lot of this is sort of symbolism and arty, and maybe it's too intellectual for me. I don't know.
There's no such thing.
Do you know what isn't symbolism and arty? This fucking title sequence.
Hello?
Do you know what? Because do you remember this was a fan-made title sequence on YouTube?
Yeah, which and is better than this version.
I remember when they announced that that was going to be the title, and I was absolutely buzzing. I thought it was the best thing I'd ever seen. And quite quickly into Series 8, I was thinking, oh, shit, this is a mistake.
Yeah, and the theme tune is just dreadful.
I think that is the worst of bit. Like, the visuals are okay, but the theme tune is too tinny.
If Murray Gold sticks around for Doctor Who for a long time, he should absolutely not be allowed to do another theme tune. Like, he can do all the other music.
I like
music,
the new one with the piano coming in.
It's the new one, isn't it?
The best version of the theme.
Not the closing one, it isn't. Not the one where it sounds like a 30-year-old man rubbing himself off.
Okay, can I ask you guys a question about the execution of this episode? Because I do think it's brilliantly directed, yeah? But it is a bit visually drab, right? Like, it doesn't pop. My eyes aren't excited by what I'm seeing. All I'm going is, yes, that looks interesting. Yes, that looks awesome.
I don't think it is drab. Like, no. I know what
you're
saying.
There's no bloody colour in the screen.
I know what you're saying about this. There's a lack of colour. Yeah, there's a certain colour palette that there is. But it still looks visually impressive. This castle feels real. It still feels in the middle of nowhere.
It can be impressive and drab at the same time.
Yeah, but Doctor Who's always big colours and big bright colours and things like that. And this is something, like, it sets the tone and it sets the mood. And also, what colour do you want a fucking castle? They're made out of stone.
I want it to be like Willy Wonka's palace.
The one in Glasgow.
Yeah.
Oh, do you know what I really didn't like was these horrible flies about the... I hate flies so much.
Yeah.
I know that's the
great
idea, isn't it?
It's all about death, so straight away you're getting that.
He's a bad taste in the mouth. I mean, props to Peter Capaldi. Literally talking to himself for an hour.
Yeah.
And Tom Baker would have loved this episode, wouldn't he?
Yeah, he would.
What other doctors do you think could have done this?
Honestly, Capaldi's not like my favourite doctor, but I don't really think there's that many.
I really want to see it with John Pertwee. I don't know why. I just like the idea of him rubbing his neck and walking around the place.
I want to see him diving out of that window. How did I get out of that then, Joe?
Surely you would like Colin in this, because he'd just be over the top and talking to himself.
I think Colin could probably do it as well.
I'd like to see Eccleston in it just because I think he'd knock down that wall with one punch.
And McCoy wouldn't be grieving for Ace or anybody else, would he? He'd just be like, yeah, she's
eating
dead.
His soup. Yeah.
He's just like, oh, love tomato soup, I do.
What I will say is, I think Peter Capaldi is the best actor to have ever played the Doctor, and this is a gift of an episode to him.
Absolutely. He's
earned this.
He absolutely has. And there was... The original version was going to be him trapped in a house with a bunch of weeping angels. Would that have tickled your tits a bit more, Joe?
Maybe. If it's the same sort of thing, though, possibly not, though.
I think it would have been exactly the same thing, just with weeping angels.
In my head, I always like the idea of getting a Capaldi Christmas special in the snow with the weeping angels. It feels like it should have happened. But no,
you almost did in Time of the Doctor, you know. There was a scene where
it's
they
not
came
Capaldi,
out.
Though.
Oh, yeah, sorry, yeah. Oh, yeah, it was Matt Smith. God.
Although he is in that episode. It's technically Capaldi's third Doctor Who episode, Time of the Doctor.
Everything about that veil creature, right, is great, apart from those big rubber hands. I think they're hilarious.
I have a problem with the veil. Oh. I think it's a really badly executed costume and lets this whole episode down.
I mean, it's mysterious.
It's a wobbly person in a thing with big wobbly hands, and then there's a slit where you can clearly see the real actor is peeking out of. This is
Can you?
No, I can't say it's ever crossed my mind.
That the first time I saw it, I laughed at it.
It's just those enormous rubber hands again.
Yeah, they didn't learn from the Silence, did they? About having big dildo fingers.
Okay, so the Doctor's just telepathically spoke to a door, got the door to open, and then is presented by a brick wall. And I think if we're going to talk about this episode reflecting dealing with depression, I think this is a really good example, an early on quick example of that he manages to overcome a hurdle only to open that, like the door, only to overcome the hurdle and hit a brick wall immediately.
I was just going to say, like, the whole thing is a metaphor for depression. At least that's what I read into it. Can I tell you my story a little bit now?
Yeah, please.
About where I was in my life when this happened. So around 2012, 2013, I was very, very depressed, suicidally depressed. I'm fine now, but I was an absolute mess of a human being. And at the same time, I fucking hated Doctor Who. It was shit. You know, Doctor Who was shit in those years.
I thought you loved Series 9.
No, this is before
this
9.
Is like Series 7, isn't it?
This is Series 7 and the 50th and then Series 8.
Oh, I get it. Don't worry, I get it.
I'm very depressed, not because of Doctor Who. But my favourite show. I'm not Ian Levine. I had a lot of issues in my life that I needed to resolve. I was stuck in a dead-end job that I didn't like. And then in 2014, in a last bid attempt to get rid of this depression, I quit my job like that and went to pursue a career in television and film. And I got a job emptying trucks for a living in events so I could just pick what work I did. I could pick my hours doing that and then do work for free or for no money on the side. And around 2015, things were starting to go well. And then this episode of Doctor Who broadcast, and I was sleeping all day because I was going to work all night. And my shift started at 11 o'clock at night, and I got up to watch this and then to go back to bed. I couldn't go back to bed because I was so fucking excited by how good this was. But Doctor Who had been getting better. My life had been getting better. And I suddenly saw within this episode, I was like, I immediately got the depression angle of it. And I was like, oh, this is what I've been going through the last few years of my life. And it was like, Doctor Who's better, I'm better, life's great, smash the shit out of it. And so that's why one of the reasons this holds a very special place in my heart.
I get that, brilliant. Because I said, not to steal your thunder, and I didn't know any of that about you, so thanks for sharing it.
My pleasure.
And I think you're wonderful. I would like to add that.
Yes, you are.
Luke Malloy's here as well, but you're wonderful. But I was talking the other day about Series 4, and when Series 4 came out, that married with a particularly great period of my life. And when Doctor Who's great and your life's going great, it's the best feeling in the world.
It is.
I'm a bit worried that this new era is going to bring about my depression, though. Yeah. I have to see a movie run.
That might be our constant fear as Doctor Who fans, is that it really can affect your life.
Do you know what day this broadcast?
I would guess it was the 28th of November, something like that.
What's 26th? The actual date, you nutty? I mean, why was it relevant question? To me?
No.
My wedding day.
Oh, fuck. Oh.
This is my wedding day episode. This is probably why I don't care for it anymore.
Did you watch it at the wedding? Did you make everybody stop?
No, we actually watched it the next day. And my other half, who was he watched the new series, but he was never a fan, literally said to me, that was the most boring thing I've ever seen. And I called off the relationship then. No, it lasted about a year after that.
Oh, that's made me really paranoid that I might...
Yeah, watch out.
Who might be broadcasting on the day that that I get married.
Well, you don't like the new era, so don't worry about it. You can miss it.
It's fine. We can duck off to the to another room and watch Doctor Who.
You did say duck off, right?
I did, yes. Okay. I'll be a married man by that point, Joe.
Oh, when's that ever stopped anyone? Come on now.
I'll save my story. It's not as heavy as Seaford knows.
I have a serious question for the two of you. And this isn't me just trying to find flaws. I want to know your answers to this question. Has Doctor Who in Series 9 and in this episode in particular forgotten that it's catering for kids?
Okay, right. One moment. We will get to that question because we've just missed like 5 minutes of Heaven Sent. I just want to pick up on a few things because I love that scene where he's in the bedroom and he gets a little eyeglass out and you can hear a bit of like Castrovalva music in
the
background.
Oh, yeah, the music.
Yeah, what is that? It's synth music, isn't it?
It is brilliant. So good. Watching it like... It suddenly just jumps into action when you're not expecting this episode to jump into action, and he jumps out the window. And I was like, that's so cool. This whole sequence where he's calculating what he's going to do in a matter of a second, all in his head.
It's too Sherlock for me, this.
This is exactly how you think Doctor is working in his head.
Yeah.
And yeah, it is Sherlock. He's clearly stole the concept from Sherlock.
I find Sherlock pretentious. So I find this pretentious.
I mean, he can't steal the concept if it's his, though, right?
Yeah, that's true. It's true. Will you answer my question now, please?
But I just think this whole sequence of him jumping out the window is brilliant, exciting, clever, and just a really fun way of just keeping the episode alive.
Oh, I love it when he goes under the water and there's all those horrible skulls there.
Yeah. All of those skulls are based on Peter Capaldi's skull, you know.
Well, that's why they're so chilling, isn't it?
But there's that you know, shot, that isn't in... there, where the skull fades into his face as the light. It's like the last visual clue before you're actually given the answer.
You know that bit in Before the Floods? They didn't even have to use makeup. They just put him up against the window. No, but the reason I asked you questions about
have they forgotten the kids?
It's because this is a very dark, very serious season with very little light relief, with a sort of unusually dark relationship between Doctor and Companion, which has been, you know, since series 8 into series 9, and now we're deep diving into grief.
Well, I mean,
why would kids want to watch this?
Two things to this, like specifically in the Heaven Sent way, is that it's just a great episode of Doctor Who, and I think as a kid, you just enjoy Doctor Who regardless. I mean,
but do kids want to watch this?
Well, I mean,
midnight
is a dark episode, which is people talking on a bus. I remember enjoying that as a kid, and I think kids enjoyed that. You could say, I mean, Nikola Tesla, Night of Terror is all fun and bouncy, but it's boring as shit.
I'm going to bring in Little Girl Who, and we'll ask her opinion.
Like, I don't think if a kid's already invested in Doctor Who, I don't think this is the episode that's going to sort of turn them off. I also think that Doctor Who was going out in a later time slot. That was something that was outside of Moffat's control.
Well. Yeah, that's
the BBC's.
Regardless of whether it's in Moffat's control or not,
now
it's
he's
a bad
writing
decision.
For a later time slot, so he's writing it slightly more adult.
I'm going to sort of be slightly contradictory here. I don't think that Doctor Who at this time is for kids. I don't think Stephen Moffat's era is for kids. I think he's purposely pitching it as
pissing on kids.
He's pissing on kids. Yeah. I think he's pitching the show at an older audience, a sort of teenage to early 20s. You know, this is when Doctor Who starts getting bigger in America as well. And he's going after fans and the fact, I don't mean fans of Doctor Who, but fans of genre. And it is for 15, 16, 17, 18, 19, 20 year olds who love genre television. I do not think this series.
Should you clear the kids out of Doctor Who?
I think it made sense at the time because the kids had grown up with Doctor Who.
Yeah, exactly.
It's why in series 10 it makes sense to set it in a university because most of the people that watch series 1, 2, 3 were at university. Suddenly it was still there.
But I think with 10 he brings it back down again. I feel like it is a bit more comic book, a lot more fun, it's a lot lighter.
Well, it probably was by accident.
Because that season shouldn't have existed.
I also think that Doctor Who shouldn't aim itself as kids because kids don't watch television anymore. It should be aimed at an older audience. And I think the new version, regardless of what I may think of it, is still aimed at older kids rather than like 7-8 year olds. 7-8 year olds are not watching Doctor Who. They're not watching television, chasing that audience. It's why that
we know that as a fact, though.
Yes,
kids are not watching television anymore.
Kids watch TikTok,
YouTube and TikTok.
Like my nieces and nephews have no interest in sitting down and watching 45 minutes of television. It's why Russell T Davies has said there won't be a Sarah Jane style spin-off in this tenure of Doctor Who because there isn't the audience for it. Chasing the child audience of Doctor Who is a way to get it cancelled at this point in the current television landscape.
I think, but this was already doing that. I think it's you that told me that at this point the BBC were as unhappy with what was being made for Doctor Who, the Doctor that was in place, the content that was being produced. They effectively sacked the showrunner and the lead actor because they were so displeased.
They didn't shut the showrunner.
Okay, replaced. They tried to replace the showrunner.
No, he wanted to leave. He was done.
So, I mean, and I think the BBC's criticism of it came from, it's not the Doctor Who from 5 years ago, rather than trying to make it evolve.
Because I can see why an adult would like this. You know, it is very arty and it is very symbolic and it is very thoughtful. I personally just don't think you should ever, ever cut out that audience.
I don't think it is cutting out, though. I think it's still quite a fun, exciting mystery and action romp.
You think this is fast and fun?
I think there's action in it that I would have liked as a kid. Yeah. The jumping out the window, the running around the castle, the veil constantly chasing.
And I think the kids would have loved the opening two-parter with the Daleks. I think they probably like the Zygons. I think they probably like the Ashilda two-parter. It's just trying different things. And also, Doctor Who's been back for a decade plus at this point, and it's earned its place for people to go, oh, you know, we can do something experimental with this slot on a Saturday night. It doesn't have to be the big fun adventure show with all the bells and whistles of, say, the Star Beast or Ruby Road. It can be something else.
Conversation as well about things being experimental, and that's fine. But just because something is experimental, it doesn't mean it's good.
No, it doesn't mean
it's just means it's different.
But this is good.
But this is good. Yeah, and it's earned. People aren't.
The point I'm trying to make is I think this is very good television. I just don't think it's very good Doctor Who.
Oh, I think it's great Doctor Who. Stephen Moffat has said, we need to stop pretending that people don't come back week on week. If this episode isn't for you, it doesn't matter, because next week is a big sprawling Gallifrey epic, and then you tune in a few weeks later and you've got that interminable shite Christmas special.
Dude, I absolutely love that.
Yeah, but there
that
you
was
go.
Like
that's
the
what
ultimate
I mean.
Refreshment.
No one's walking away from Doctor Who after this and going, this is the worst bit of television I've ever seen. I'm never watching it.
Once we got this season out of the way, things started picking up, didn't they, numbers-wise?
No, Doctor Who ratings only do well when the BBC do a big promo launch. You know,
I was at a party and I was speaking to a girl who just joined our work, and she asked me about Doctor Who. She asked me what my favourite episode was, and I said this, and she was said, this was the one that made me stop watching. But she's weird. She's weird.
I think this is the sort of Doctor Who you could show people. You know, we always say, you wouldn't want someone to walk in. But you could. It's a very respectable piece of television, you know?
I'd show them something a bit less intense, because
something more fun, you mean?
I don't think this is very reflective of Doctor Who as a whole. It's a one-off, isn't it?
Okay, I'm gonna shut up. You guys say nice things.
Okay, well, I'll tell you my story then, because obviously I was very excited for this episode. As the spoiler-free reviews had hyped it up, and then days before, as I find out that Rachel's sister and husband are coming up and we're going out all night, and I'm thinking, oh fuck. But that's the night the most best episode of Doctor Who ever's going to be on. We go around Leeds Christmas markets. I'm being bought mulled wine and expensive pies. And yeah, it's nice. But in the back of my head, I'm looking at my phone. And it's 8:05 p.m. And I'm like, oh, it started. The one you had to watch that I'm not watching and everyone else is. And then 9 o'clock, it finishes. My phone's on airplane mode. Just wouldn't touch it. 10 o'clock, there's still 12:30, we're drinking. So it's 2:30 in the morning when we're watching it. Well, when I'm watching it, Rachel's asleep next to me and I've got my laptop open. And I didn't know anything about it. And I pressed play, and honestly, that 55 minutes, it felt like it was Doctor Who for me and nobody else. Like it was going out.
Well, it was. No one else was watching it at that point.
It felt like it was going out live at 2:30 a.m. And I was watching it, and they made it for me. And when the Doctor falls to the floor and declares he's been there for like 7,000 years, and the penny drops and you just see all these clues, finally, my jaw just proper hit the floor. And that was just a true Doctor Who high. And then when it finishes and it's joyous, I woke up Rachel. I was obliged to tell her what had just happened, to which she told me to piss off and go
fuck
to sleep.
Fuck off, Luke! do you know what? 2:30 in the morning, blissed out on mulled wine. I mean, this must have felt like a fever dream watching this.
It was just, I just couldn't wait to wake up and watch it again. And it's the very first thing I did. Just a laptop open, bang, get it on again. It's just the best thing I'd ever seen.
It must be me.
I agree.
It must be me. I just don't get it.
And you
it
would think an episode me. That's almost so reliant on a twist, the Doctor just being 3D printed again and again, should sort of lose its rewatchability. But I do think there's probably something in the fact that it's dealing with such themes and doing it so well that you can recognise different parts that work on each occasion. Mm. And you could sort of put different pieces of the puzzle together on different occasions.
Can I just say, if it is true that, like, Capaldi was almost out at this point, yeah?
Yeah.
Technically, Capaldi was almost out. He was technically fired. He had no, like, he didn't have to deliver this performance. He could have been going, well, fuck this shit. I'm just going to phone it in.
I don't think he was stood there going, oh, I've been fired when he was doing this. My understanding is at the end of the Christmas special that was supposed to be Moffat's last hurrah, they didn't know what they were doing next. And that involved, you know, the conversation within the BBC very much at least was, Capaldi's gone, we don't want Capaldi anymore. So okay. I don't think he would have known until afterwards. I don't think it's the sort of thing you tell your leading actor on the set.
and here's this massively arty script, off you go. Please but also, give the best performance of a Doctor ever.
He's both a professional and a fan. Yeah, so yeah. He comes back in Series 10 and gives some great performances.
Well, I mean, you've only got to see what a professional he is in how his decorum since he's left. Yeah. If all of that is true, then since he left the part, he's been extremely polite about it all.
Although you can sense the seething in every quote.
It's no Eccleston, though, is it? It's like sack Russell T. Davis.
Sack Stephen Moffat. Oh no, he's not doing it anymore, is he? Or is he?
Yeah, he'll be back.
It's what, like all maybe. The clues in this, it's one of those Moffat things where once you know it, you're like, how did my brain not see that? I mean, the clothes by the fireplace is so, it's almost so brave to put it there because it should be giving
it's too
away
obvious in a way.
Episode, but, yeah. But he does do that with quite a lot of his twists.
Can I talk about the body now very quickly?
Whose body?
The Buffy episode, the body.
Right.
So, sorry, Luke. Joyce Summers dies and Buffy finds her dead on the sofa. And the next episode along, yeah, is the most exceptional handling of the emptiness of what happens after you lose somebody that I've ever seen. Because it is an episode devoid of drama and structure. And it is just those people dealing with the emotions that they're feeling and the emptiness and the nothing that happens. Yeah. That to me, that's how I felt when I lost my mum. Absolutely empty, useless. I didn't know what to do with myself. All I had was that outpouring of grief. I wasn't in a puzzle box. I wasn't going around being witty and jumping out of windows and all of this. And I know we're dealing with however old Time Lord dealing with grief in this, who deals with things in different ways. But this, to me, this does not feel like grief.
I mean, you say that, it may not feel like your sort of grief, and that's not to...
And that's what I'm saying. That's the only eyes I can see through.
I had a conversation with a Doctor Who fan in a pub a couple of years ago, I think it was, and he talked about exactly the same thing about losing his mom and this episode and grief. And he was like, that episode perfectly encapsulates how I felt about losing my mom and the grief that he was still going through years later.
I would say Hellbent taps more into the grief I felt, that sort of fury, and I'm going to tear down everything because I'm so angry that I've lost that person. Whereas all of this cleverness, all of this pretension, I don't know, it feels like it's just trying a bit too hard.
I think this is clever, but I don't think it's pretentious.
No, I don't either. I think
the difference, maybe. I mean,
I'm now going to tell you very cleverly how I did that isn't pretentious.
Yeah, but then he looks at the camera and he goes, I don't know. Which is a joke.
He looks at the camera at one point and goes, I'm nothing without an audience as well.
Yeah.
Wow, exactly. Pretentious. I would say Stephen Moffat knows how to write a script without being pretentious, if I'm honest.
I don't think he's pretentious at all. I find Russell T. Davis is writing a lot more pretentious than
absolutely. His. Absolutely. Just more fun.
But I would say that obviously not seeing the Buffy episode, I took my earphone out for most of that, but obviously not seeing it. I think that is
it's extraordinary.
Going straight into dealing with it. Whereas this is a Doctor Who episode laced with depression and grief in it. But like you can still enjoy it without it. It's still just a romp around the castle without it.
Do you know what unkind thought I had was, oh, actually, maybe Time Flight did do it better, because what you have to do in life is just fucking get on with your life, you know, and deal with the grief at the same time. I was in the early stages of being a manager and I couldn't walk away from that. I just lost my mum, but I just had to get on with it, you know. I couldn't spend 4 billion years punching a diamond wall.
Very true, very true. I just need to go back to the Veil. When it came in the room then, it looked like a bunch of kids in a Mac, you know, on top of each other's shoulders.
I really like that.
It really takes me out of the episode. That's my only issue really with the episode, that, and I don't understand why the room with the wall doesn't reset, but we'll forget about that.
Can I say something really nice?
Stephen Moffat's column in Doctor Who magazine where he explained all the bits of Heaven Sent that people have problems with?
No, I didn't.
Yeah, there's a whole column.
Have you got it?
I haven't got it on me, but we can find it. Because he goes around the castle naked the first time around, the Doctor, because he loses his clothes jumping in the water.
And we just don't see it.
Yeah, so from then on he's naked. Because this is like the, you know, 5,000th Doctor to go around the castle or something. But there's definitely a reason why Room 12 doesn't reset in that.
Interesting.
Will you do me a favour? Will you find that article, read it, like do an audio recording of it, and I'll beam you in like William Hartnell. Ding, 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 into the episode.
Yeah.
I mean, look at that shot there with the light coming through the window while he's eating at the table.
I don't know what it is. There's something about this, the soup dropping from this spoon in slow-mo, that really captures the eternity of that castle. I don't know.
Well, there's soup in Hellbent as well, isn't there? There's a lot of symbolism around soup.
This Doctor loves soup. I'm going through my soup era at the moment. I'm eating a lot of soup, so, you know.
Can I ask what your soup of choice is, Dylan?
I like a French onion.
Your breath must stink. I like mulligatawny.
I like a muggler.
Luke, what's your soup?
I honestly fucking love tomato and basil with black pepper and cheese in it.
I'm there with you, but I'm there. I just want the Heinz tomato soup with a cheese sandwich.
Yes, I just honestly love tomato soup. It's great.
I want to have lunch with you two. Those both sound great.
It's a cheap lunch.
So the nice thing I wanted to say, because I can say nice things, is just the locations they've chosen for this are extraordinary. Yeah. There was a shot a minute ago in that church, you know, it was a high angle shot, and you just saw that extraordinary room inside that church. Fabulous.
Have you been to any?
No.
What churches?
Have you been to any of these locations?
No, have you?
We went to go to the Heaven Sent Castle and by accident went to the wrong castle. And we went to the one from Nightmare in Silver and it was
Luke, no.
But this was filmed over like two or three castles, I think. A little bit's in Cardiff, a little bit's in Caerphilly. But yeah, we ended up in Warwick Davis's Hedgebrook's World of Wonders.
Gutted.
I mean, that episode, my argument's out the window, because that episode is geared for kids and it's terrible. What's the bird thing all about?
It's a reminder. It's a hell of a bird.
He's reminded himself of the story. Of the story about a bird that knocks down the Diamond Mountain, because that's what he's going to have to do.
Why does he need a reminder?
Because he's not yet figured it out that's what's going to happen to him.
But what's going to happen to him?
When he dies, he writes bird in the sand and then burns up, so that his next one will see the bird in the sand and at the right moment remember the story of the bird knocking down the Diamond Mountain. So he then has to start knocking down the Diamond Wall.
I thought there was some sort of metaphor I was missing. It's just because the bird's in the story.
Yeah, but the bird is a metaphor for him.
I'm not sure I was paying attention at this point, if I'm honest. And this bit in a minute where they go outside the castle and there's all the stars in the sky. Oh, that looks lovely as well.
I was getting through the door and being presented by a brick wall, not being able to get through doors of the mind. That is like a big thing in this. And I think the castle itself is the brain, isn't it? It's nonsensical. It's where the cogs turn. Rooms reset. You can't stay in one place for too long. It's all sort of a metaphor for the brain, especially the brain during depression. So that is all at play.
Absolutely.
Who's put him in there?
The Time Lords.
The Time Lords.
Do we know that?
Yeah, we do. I think.
Yeah. Because it happens in Hellbent. They talk about right at the beginning about them needing to put in there to know what he knows about the hybrid.
Yeah, because the only reason he's not telling the secret of the hybrid is so he can get out to Gallifrey to steal an extraction chamber to save Clara.
I can't wait for you all to explain to me what the hell the hybrid was all about. I'm still very confused about that.
I like the hybrid.
Yeah. We'll come to that in the next episode.
It's one for intellectuals.
Well, I'm out then.
Now, of course, technically, this is the Doctor Who story with the most amount of Doctors in as a multi-Doctor story. But there's about 400 of them in this episode.
Come on, Dylan. If that thing was coming up behind you, it'd be chilling.
It looks like a dick in a sheet.
The thing that really makes it work is the flies.
The flies are cool. It just looks so wobbly.
Well, it's Doctor Who still, you know.
I know, but there's always something that lets an episode of Doctor It's this.
I'd like to point out at this juncture, this is the same director as the Star Beast, Mr. Dylan Reese.
Yes, both
brilliant Doctor Who episodes.
I'll say one's more geared towards children, wouldn't you?
Yes, I would say one's. But she directed Death in Heaven. She directed Twice Upon a Time, The Doctor Falls.
She does like a filter, though, doesn't she? Because she uses that ghastly filter in the Death in Heaven graveyard sequences, doesn't she?
Oh, yeah.
There's definitely one in The Doctor Falls, although everyone talks about how good World Nothing Time is. Doctor Falls is a better episode. There's mine.
Well, we'll reconvene for that one, shall we?
Capaldi zapping bombs from the ground. Oh, my God. Amazing.
It's one of the best moments in Doctor Who.
Peak
Doctor Who, yeah.
I think as a whole, that's one of the best Doctor Who stories ever, the two episodes together.
Me too.
Great. I'm glad we can all agree on that.
I heard someone the other day describe it as, it's nice when Doctor Who doesn't do fan wank. Talked about that episode. And I'm like, there's two masters, three versions of the Cybermen.
Oh, Luke, you just reminded me of something.
Sorry, go on.
Well, it's because it ties into something you said in Spyfall about not liking the angle they were taking with Jodie's Doctor. Yeah,
I don't think it was that. I mean, I just didn't like Jodie's Doctor. It wasn't an angle. There was no angles.
But the reason why I love Jodie's Doctor so much and I find her so refreshing is because I was just so sick to death of all this fucking man pain that we're doing all the time. It's so bloody tedious.
I get that, because when you look at series 8 and 9 as a whole from afar, you're just like,
get over yourself and just have some adventures.
But if you actually go into the individual episodes, they're never as bad as what you think the series is as a whole.
But taken as a whole, it's a lot.
It feels like it on the surface.
I'd say.
Oh, thoughts on the Sonic Specs, people?
Fine. I mean, a sonic screwdriver is a stupid idea anyway. Yeah. So why not sonic specs? The things that, but at the same time, I hate those fucking Mavity gloves in Ruby Road. So
I fucking hate the Mavity gloves. But when he slaps them on his face, in which is familiar, and goes, Clara, it's all about wearable tech. I was like, this is amazing. So to find out that everyone hated them, I was shocked.
The specs, the tank, the guitar. Brilliant. Midlife crisis doctor.
Well, yeah.
Where's
his
fucking sports car? You know, shaped like a penis.
I love the design of this wall, and that we've just missed it. That corridor, as he walked towards it.
So, what's the metaphor here, then? What's the wall all about?
Well, it's about battling through, isn't it?
Yeah, on a very basic level, it's just about battling your depression. Yeah. Something that you can never defeat that eventually gets defeated.
Yeah, and you break on through to the upper
and
side.
And that's how it feels, painfully punching through a wall that's never going to break.
Yeah.
I mean, although he does punch in some weird places. But I can't tell you, this wasn't how I got out of it.
Well, that's why it's a metaphor, Joe.
Yeah, but it wasn't even the equivalent of the metaphor of this.
He does punch in some weird places, though, because he has this whole ring around him where you think cut yourself some millions of years off and just punch in a straight line.
I don't know why he didn't go back for that spade.
Yeah, a lot of people I've heard that criticism. Moffat said in the DWM column, the spade resets.
Right, of course.
Is that Jenna Louise Coleman, or is that Jenna Louise Coleman standing?
It is her. Everybody said, oh, it's not her. You can tell it's someone in a wig, and it's like, no, it is actually her.
So at this moment, watching it the first time, I still didn't know what was going on. I still hadn't clicked what was going on.
It takes a... I think for me, it took like a... I was like, oh, that's interesting that it's repeating. And then all of a sudden, I'm like, hang on, he said a different amount of years. Is that a mistake? Oh, that I remember that thought process.
Yeah, it was... So the bit on the floor where he says, when I first got here 7,000 years ago, I remember my blood running cold, but still not really knowing why this was the... And then, yeah, it is that looking at the stars 10 billion years into the future. Oh.
Am I missing something? What's going on?
What do you mean?
Well, you say I didn't realise what was going on, so you reached a revelation of something going on. What was going on?
We're not at that bit yet.
No, but explain it to me.
It's the bit when he realises that he's got to kill himself over and over and over again to create the new one.
He gets there before the audience does.
Yeah.
And that he's been doing this for an awfully long time.
This is him getting here before the audience knows, and Clara telling him, you can fucking do this.
Yeah.
And he's just that little bit of help, that little bit of extra push that he needs. And I remember people hated this because it ruined the fact it was a one-hander. This is a great scene. I would not take this out in a million years.
Yeah, me neither.
Get up off your arse and win.
Is it the first use of arse in Doctor Who?
I don't know, but which is familiar had bitch in it, didn't it?
Yeah.
But Kill the Moon. Kill the Moon had bloody, didn't it?
I think we had a bloody before, didn't we?
And
we
had Kill the Moon have cool.
Oh, I'm on the bloody moon.
You left me there on the moon, you cunt.
He would if he could.
He would.
I mean, he's pushing the time slot, you know. He's almost at 9 o'clock.
But I'm sure I remember them saying they had to check with the BBC that they could use as much blood as they did, and that plays into the later time slot. I think
this is the only episode where I remember blood. I remember seeing the blood and thinking, "Ooh, that's quite out there for Doctor Who." When it's on his hands and knuckles,
not for season 22, it isn't.
No, people need to get over that by now.
I love it. I love it.
In The Last of the Time Lords, the Master has the tiniest bit of blood on his shirt, and Russell T. Davies and Phil Collinson said that they really ummed and ahed about whether to have any blood at all, and whether to like use a space gun or something to shoot him. But it made it all the more real. Because if you get shot in your stomach like the Master does, you should see Reservoir Dogs and compare to
I figured that's why they put Lucy in that red dress, you know, with the gun. That was sort of the...
Yeah, it's definitely there, but she's also like a trophy wife, isn't she? Then manages to snap out of it.
Oh, I mean, I also still like punching that wall, folks.
I also like that the solution to the problem is just punching a wall. You know, I think in a series where there's been quite a lot of speeches and things like that, the fact that he literally just has to do this again and again until he breaks through is...
You
great.
Think violence is the answer, Luke Malloy?
Oh, yeah, I love it when the Doctor punches someone. Why do you think everyone
come
likes...
Come here, then. I'll disagree with you. Come on.
Why do you think everyone likes season 13? Because Tom Baker goes around and punches every fucker in the face.
Oh, yeah, that's
he gasses,
very cool.
He gasses cool. The guy in the brain of Morbius. He twists Scorby's neck.
Chauffeur, he punches right over a quarry, doesn't
punches
he?
Punches him, yeah. He's this punching in Planet of Evil. Everyone loves it.
Yeah.
Powering down, folks. Powering down.
And John Pertwee does it all with karate, doesn't he?
Hmm.
People
think it's fine because it's got a different name.
Yeah, a spacey name.
I will say one thing for the last 15 minutes. The editing is out of this world.
It's 100% the best edited Doctor Who.
It tells the story and it gains momentum is... Well, I say extraordinary a lot, but it is extraordinary.
And it is that Murray's music underneath it, the Shepherd's Boy... Astonishing. Brilliant. That was the one out of them all in that concert when they did the TV version of the concert in September and they took the Shepherd's Boy out. That was the biggest crime of it all.
Look at his face. Oh, that's ghastly.
It is.
I think Peter Capaldi's the only actor to play the Doctor that when he dies, he actually looks like he's died.
Does he do the John Pertwee thing and put his leg up in the air?
He should.
No, when he's on the floor of the TARDIS in the memory palace in a minute and his eyes go in the back of his head, you think, Fuck.
I also feel a bit sorry for Peter Capaldi here, because it's not going to be a pleasant experience crawling up that those stairs, even as an actor.
You see him crawling up those stairs there. That's me watching this episode. Oh, when will I get to the top?
See, that shot of his hand, though, with all the blood in the chest, like, that makes me feel a bit...
That's horrible.
So it is tough. But the fact, I mean, this only adds to the solution, though, that it's such a hard, grueling thing to do, and he does it an infinite amount of times.
You remember when Rachel Talele said that, you know, Moffat scripts were unfilmable and she used to have to beat them into shape to try and get them filmed? No, that's a genuine quote that she said. I'm wondering if this was one of them, you know. She goes, oh, don't worry, we'll sort it all out with the visuals, all right? We'll make it look great.
Yeah, but she's not saying unfilmable in a negative way. That's brilliant.
How the fuck did we do this?
Yeah, yeah.
It depends how you read it, really, isn't it?
Well, she's worked with him many times. Yeah. So
I bet she didn't have that problem with the Starbucks. She was like, oh, we just need a car park and a shit CGI. Oh!
Can we do the Starbucks next, please?
Absolutely.
I want Dylan to be the horrible one.
Now, also the use of blood, really, it is shocking, like you were saying, Luke, but I think it's part of the episode, and that's what's the... It makes it more shocking, because your brain's going, there's blood in Doctor Who. I haven't seen this in Doctor Who. I've never seen like wounds that visceral, at least in the new series.
Yeah, yeah. And it's like, he's actually dying. He's actually going through pain. And again, all that is adding to it.
Yeah.
It was this bit now when he says, I got here 7,000 years ago. And I still, if I watch it like on my own properly, my blood will run cold. I can feel that moment of realization that he's got to do this. Yeah. And yet, if he just said what the hybrid was, which is basically a load of bollocks, he'd get let out. But he wouldn't get let out on Gallifrey, and that's the difference.
I love these low shots as well they do of the transporter or the 3D printer or whatever you want to call it. And it's just shot. It's a fairly basic construction in terms of
look at those lovely big levers they've got, though.
The levers are great. The lighting's great. So it just looks really cool. It looks like this daunting, daunting moment.
He's in a bad way there, isn't he?
Yeah.
Yeah.
He looks like Two-Face from
The Dark Knight. He does. Again, they didn't need to put any makeup on him. That's just how he comes to work, you know?
And when he dies in a second and all the screens go black and static, I mean, he's gone.
He's gone.
He's gone.
R.I.P. to PCAP.
I mean, that is a really dark line, that all you need for energy is something to burn. And then you watch the doctor, he's got a face full of blood, burn himself alive. I mean, I can understand that this, as you're saying, is not the greatest episode for kids. Saying that, I'd loved this as a kid. I think I was watching something really growing up when I was a kid. So I think we underestimate them sometimes.
Oh, no, I just mean in terms of sort of pace and incident. I just don't think
he jumped out of a fucking window 10 minutes in. Come on.
Yeah, it lasted 30 seconds. Then he walked around the castle again for another half an hour.
No, 5 minutes.
Riveting stuff.
And then, yeah, we start to get the montage.
But, you know, I absolutely acknowledge everything you're saying. And I can see how much this means to you. So it just baffles me that I just have no reaction to it.
It is quite baffling.
It's supposed to be.
I'm trying to puzzle it out now. I'm like, is this just making a mockery of regeneration? Is it making a mockery of death that he's dying and coming back to life again?
It's not a mockery, though. It's him going through the pain and the grief and the castle over and over again just to hit a wall, just to make a dent, just to die again, to restart again. All that so... one day, one incalculable day in the future, he can get out and save his
best friend. How does that equate to grief in a way we can understand? Make that link for me.
It doesn't necessarily have to be the exact same thing. It's just if you want to read into it.
But in any way.
Grief and depression, quite a lot of time, can feel like you're just punching down a wall that will never go away. And this is giving you, keep going, and you will get through the wall. It's how I would see it.
Yeah, it's the process of just trying to get through each day and each day feeling the same and feeling empty and just eat as much as you don't want to continue, you have to continue. It's a bit like sitting down and listening to all of Once and Future in one day.
Oh, now I get it.
Relatable. Ooh, that would
be over and over again.
Terminable. Now, is the Shepherd's Boy playing at this point?
Yeah.
Because I would just like to say, I mean, that's my most listened to piece of Doctor Who music of all time.
Mine.
Apart from the Master reveal in Spyfall. Sorry, Luke. I love that bit as well.
I only like that because of Evil Dan.
Well, you did say that last time, yes. but this is just... It's almost too good to be a piece of music in Doctor Who.
I don't listen to Doctor Who music very often.
Well, you're missing out.
But I do have with me right now Myths and Other Legends, which is the music from the Mythmakers tapes by Mark Ayres, which I listened to yesterday.
Too hot for TV.
An interesting little tidbit that I quite like. There is in Day of the Doctor, when the three doctors are sort of talking about pressing the button, there is a bit of the Shepherd's Boy there, like a really early version of it. That
really?
Yeah, genuinely. And with it being like a really significant event time.
Do they use it again in when he died in his last season?
Oh, yeah, when he's regenerating.
Yeah, definitely. I thought so, yeah.
Never, never eat purrs.
Mind you, the best bit of regeneration music ever is, and I never thought I'd say this, in Time of the Doctor, that beautiful music from the Rings of Akatin that they use in that. That's just gorgeous.
I probably prefer End of Time.
It
sounds like they're singing, I need a church.
I need a church.
Talk about fucking pretentious. That choir.
Bloody it's hell. Pretentious, but oh, it was a fucking hit at the time.
Maybe that's it. Mate, I think my issue is this wasn't great for me. That I think that's my big issue. That's why this doesn't. I imagine your brother, because your brother said to me, Dylan, the other day when he watches a lot of Stephen Moffat stuff, it makes him cry. And he says when he watches this, he literally is weeping buckets. Yeah. So it resonates somewhere with something in his life, because that's usually when something makes you cry, not just because it's a moving piece of television. So I think maybe that's just my problem.
It was living with me talking about Doctor Who throughout his entire childhood. That's how he relates to this.
I think
for 4.5 billion years.
He's the original little girl who forced to listen to watch Doctor Who again and again.
Why he sort of basically rejected it now? You know.
Yes.
This one is this one that makes me more excited because the puzzle pieces are fitting in and the music's swelling. So this doesn't get me particularly emotional, but there's scenes in Hellbent that get me emotional if I watched it properly.
I was surprised how much some of those scenes in Hellbent snuck
out. And some of the scenes in the diner, the dialogue, it's literal gorgeous poetry, arty farty as that sounds.
Do you know as well, though, obviously this is about the absence of a companion and him dealing with that, yeah? I think it made me realise, I need the companion there. Because I'll say it again, the second Hellbent started and they were together and the warmth of it. And I was like, yes, this is Doctor Who. Let's go.
What do you think of the Deadly Assassin? Like, genuinely? No.
I don't go back to it very often.
Yeah, so there is some...
It's cold like this. It's very cold.
I think with the Deadly Assassin and with this, the show has to earn it. You can't take it for granted. That it can just do something like that in like episode 2 of a new era or something like that.
I mean, I will say, like, I've said a lot of criticism, but I am so pleased this exists. I'm so pleased they did this. Because if you
even though it comes out at the top of the polls, are you still pleased?
Who cares what those people think, Luke? Have you seen what's at the bottom of those polls? Some of them are great.
Yeah, no, I agree. It's the only placement on the poll that I agree with.
I mean, who the fuck reads Doctor Who magazine these days? Who pays $10.99 for that fucking trash?
Some fucking losers, yeah.
I'm not spending an hour of my working wage to see pictures of the editor putting out magazines all over the TARDIS console.
No.
Seriously, if you want to read the Gallifreyan Guardian, I'll send it you over there.
Oh, send it, please.
When he picked up the confession dial just then and the castle was in it and it closed over, I was still punching the air at this point. Like, for me, the revelations keep going and keep going, and you know he's on Gallifrey. You can just feel it. And then when you get that shot, I literally came in my pants and started crying at the same time.
My heart was beating so quick at this point.
Yeah, because there's nowhere else it can be. And he almost, not this episode, but Gallifrey almost returned at the end of Series 8. That was the original plan.
I can't remember whether... Did we know about this before Heaven Sent?
What,
did
Gallifrey
we know?
Was...
I feel like there was some... In the synopsis, it was like, the Doctor's going to get to Gallifrey.
They didn't say it on this, but the synopsis for the next episode was released, which mentioned Gallifrey.
Oh, right, yeah. But I don't remember. It didn't matter.
It was the Radio Times listing, and it was like, it said something like, the Doctor must battle through all eternity to get back to Gallifrey.
Yeah, something like that. But I don't remember it mattering a jot. Like, no. I at this moment, I was just like, I can't believe what I'm watching.
I was just thinking, oh, God, here we go. Arc of Infinity of the new series. Because I've never liked stories set on Gallifrey, so it's just not my bag.
Well, we'll get into that in a moment. But
yeah. Can I say a little spoiler? None of the Gallifrey stuff is what thrilled me about Hellbent watching this morning. It was mostly the character stuff, which I thought was very, very good. Very, very good. Well, boys, sorry to be a party pooper. Now's your chance to tell me precisely where I've gone wrong with your three fabulous reasons as to why Heaven Sent is the number one Doctor Who story, as voted by everybody except me.
I'm really going to struggle to find three things in a weird way. Because it's the whole thing for me. Yeah. Like, I there's nothing I can pick out as... I can find one thing I dislike about it, and that's it.
Okay, well, that's fair. Luke?
I mean, apart from, like, just the usual things, the music and whatever, I think it's just that it's one of them Doctor Who episodes that still gives me goosebumps and thrills and just... emotion on rewatch, you know what I mean? It just takes me back to that night in Leeds in bed at 2:30 in the morning. That like really big Doctor Who high that I'm not sure has ever been matched since like the World Enough in Time.
What about the Vanquishers?
World Enough in Time might have come close when you know John Sim came out, but no, there was nothing like that. And it with it feeling like it was being transmitted right for me and that nobody else was watching it and the Doctor Who was mine. I mean, you know, as you said, it feels like it's written for the fans and it's written for adults, and at that time it really did feel like it was for me. And so it has the personal aspects. I mean, that bit where the Doctor's just sort of look at the stars and the timestamp in his life. I mean, I timestamped my life with where it was when Doctor Who was on. It's sort of a lot easier to know where you watch that. So every time he does that, I can just think of myself as, oh, what happened in 2013? Oh, well, you know, Cold War was on at the end of March. So where was I in Cold War? You know, it's like you do sort of work around that.
Absolutely. I think we all do that, you know.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I can't explain that sort of Doctor Who's constant occupation in my brain, but we all have it.
You can to us.
You know, we all
have it.
You can't
to anyone else in your life, but you can to us.
Yeah, but when it said it's most unpredictable and most creative and most magical, like it is here, there's just nothing else like it. And I think us fans worry about a million different things about what Doctor Who should be and can be and everything. And then on the very odd night like this night where everything falls into place and it's perfect, there's just nothing else like it.
Absolutely. I had the same response to the timeless child.
Fuck off.
I did.
Dylan, you were doing so well with this episode.
Don't follow that up with... follow that up with that. Come on.
Can I... So I'll be the one that does three things then, because I can't believe that's me.
Well, no, like Rachel Talalay's directing, yeah, Maury Gold Shepherd's Boy.
I was going to say all those things. Shut
Peter
up,
Capaldi. Peter Capaldi dying.
That's why you can't do it, because it's just all there.
Yeah, it's just all there.
I was going to say the three personal bests. I think it's Talalay's personal best. I think it's Capaldi's personal best. And I think it's Maury Gold's personal best. I shall say it's Stephen Moffat's personal best, because I think it's really boring. But all those three, I think... are delivering the best work.
And it's the script that makes it boring, do you think?
That's the story. It's the depiction of grief in a very strange way. But you know what? Horses for courses. We all come at this from different directions, do we not?
The script is really interesting.
One of us didn't like Spyfall, remember? Madness.
The script is really interesting because that the montage, as you see it at the end, when it with the whole 7,000, 10,000 into the future, every bit of it is in the script. It's not like it's just gone montage of this over and over again. It, as it appears on the screen, is exactly how it's scripted. It's a masterpiece of scripting.
And fair play to Talele as well. She didn't reuse any footage. Every time you see a repeat of something, it's a new take.
Yeah.
So there's no just, oh, well, you've walked down that corridor once. We can do it again. Like, they do a new take for every little bit.
Yeah.
And just to finish that thought, one of us did not like The Star Beast. Also directed by Rachel Talele.
Yeah. But, you know.
And similarly wonderful.
Yeah, but you can't polish a turd, can you?
But will one of us not like Hellbent, also directed by Rachel Talele? Well, we'll have to find out, won't we?
Well, no, we've all just said we liked it in this episode.
Oh, shit, yeah.
There's very little suspense there.
He's trying to move us on.
Oh, yeah, I see. On. Oh, okay. Well, come on, let's fucking get on with it then.
Okay, well, we'll... Do you want to cut it there?